Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Hello friends, how are you? Welcome along to Soundtrackin' with me, Edith Bowman. I was just waxing lyrical just before I started there. I wasn't really talking to anyone. I was just almost talking to Ben in a recorded sort of atmosphere and offloading on him, which is kind of a weird one. But one of the things that I wanted to start doing in the podcast, which I do, I mean, I talk about Ben all the time on the show. He's been with me since the start of this journey, but I've been listening to quite a lot of different podcasts over the past couple of weeks. It's amazing how many people are involved in podcasts. When you hear at the end of a podcast, they go, this episode was edited by this person, produced by this person, waxed by this person. It's really, really funny. But it's pretty much Ben and I with Callie on the side doing all our socials. So this episode is brought to you by the wonderful Ben Backhouse, as it is every week. So I just wanted to say thank you, Ben. And our latest episode, also because Ben jumps in when I've got, please, can we do 2 episodes this week? I've got this person and that person. And he never says no. He's just an absolute trooper. So thank you, sir. I appreciate you so much. And I know our listeners do as well, because you make the podcast sound brilliant. So thank you so much. So listen, friends, our latest episode of Soundtrackin' is with a gentleman by the name of Neil Forsyth. He is a wonderful Scottish man from Dundee, Broughty Ferry to be exact. And he's a writer of many things, most recently the hit BBC show The Gold, the second season of which is now available to watch in full on BBC iPlayer. Now, the show stars Hugh Bonneville, Dominic Cooper, Charlotte Spencer, Sean Harris, Jack Loudon and Tom Cullen. And they were all very much part of season one. Some of them may well continue into season two. You'll have to wait to find out. And it's a dramatisation of events around the Brinks Matt robbery in 1983, where, as the title would suggest, a load of gold was stolen. It's a true story. And what I'm really excited about sharing with you is the journey that Neil takes as the creator of the show based around the story, you know, in terms of writing that and how he does that, you know, what that involves, the research, the people that he talks to. I'm also really excited because Neil is the man behind one of my favourite shows of the past decade. It's a show called Guilt, and it's set in Scotland about these two brothers. And I think we had 3 seasons of it. And for me, I was just blown away by it. I thought it was such a great, fresh take on Scotland and how you present Scotland and how it really captured the kind of dark comedy that is very much, I think anyway, can be part of kind of Scottish trait. So if you haven't watched Guilt yet, then maybe after listening to this, you can go and dive into it. It's absolutely brilliant. It's hilarious as well. But The Gold Season 2 is scored by Simon Gough and we'll begin with his cue closing in. Thanks so much for jumping on. I've been wanting to get you on for ages. I mean, I've been wanting to get you on since Guilt, to be honest, because I love that show so much. But Gold has just been, what a gift as well. And I've watched the first 4 episodes of season 2. Oh, it's great. It's so addictive. What was the hook for you to start with? What was the kind of, what was it about the these characters and the story that you kind of just wanted to dive in, really?
It's just such a good story. I mean, it's, you know, you kind of get pitched quite a lot of new stories as a sort of television writer. And a lot of the time when you look through it, or even things that I read about and think, oh, that sounds interesting, and I look into it more, the biggest problem in my experience is there's just not enough story. So you think, well, no, that is interesting and unexpected and surprising, but ultimately 5 things happen. That would be a really good film.
Yeah. But
if you want to write 6 episodes of television, and particularly if you want to write with a decent pace and sort of burn through story, you just need so much to start with. And it's so unusual to find a true story that is dynamic and unique and interesting and has that kind of scale, if you like, and that you can write it over that canvas. And the Gold is, you know, just the more I researched it, just the more there was to it. It's incredible. It's this kind of sprawling story that goes off in all these mad tangents all over the world, through lots of different worlds, lots of different characters.
So many
for
characters.
A dramatist, yeah, for a dramatist, it's a bit of a dream, really.
It's funny because I was watching it and going, you probably know more than the police do when it comes to, like, there's the kind of police investigation going on, and then there's the kind of, like, you know, them existing and trying to kind of, you know, do all these different characters of trying to keep away from the law in a way. The way that you construct that is so clever and brilliant that I can't imagine how much research you had to do to kind of really get the kind of, obviously there's creative license in there, you know what I mean? But just to be able to kind of navigate that journey that we go on of these kind of cut the cat and mouse sort of vibe to it.
The research, so the first series, Thomas Turner researched with me. We had so much material generated. The two of us did a book together called The Gold, which is just out in paperback as well. But then, and then Thomas and then Adam Fenn as well worked. Another researcher on the second series. And it's crazy. I mean, I really enjoy the research period, to be honest. I mean, to be fair, they do a lot of the kind of the hard yards, if you like, and I'm sort of reading what they're generating and saying, well, let's get more of this. Don't worry about that so much. I'm not sure that'll fit. And it's all pre-internet as well, this stuff. You know, a lot of it was just pouring through newspaper archives from the 80s and early 90s, none of which is online. So, you know, they're literally working through newspapers. They know rough dates of court cases, so they'll pull the newspapers for 2 weeks either side. You know, it's kind of pretty old school journalistic research, really. And it just generates, with both series, what we end up with is just this enormous document that I'll then go through and slowly start finessing and say, like, I think here's the characters I want to concentrate on. Here's the worlds I want to concentrate on. Get more on those worlds. And then it's just constantly trying to boil it down and make it fit into 6 episodes. But really, it can be really exciting. You know, you get an excited call from a researcher that just found something and, you know, newspaper article. A good example is in the opening episode of series 2. There's a storyline around suggestion that a large amount of the Brixmack gold ended up down a Cornish tin mine. That was one paragraph of an Evening Standard article in the late 80s. You know, one throwaway paragraph where it says, a tiny little story, and it said, Cornish police have been, there have been extensive police work going on Cornish moors, and it's emerged that there's a link with Brinksmack gold, and that Cornish police are working on solid intelligence that a significant amount of Brinksmack gold has been hidden down a tin mine. And you know, you read that's you know, from nearly 40 years ago now, that newspaper article, one paragraph in that, and I, you know, that becomes a storyline in the opening episode of the second series. I mean, it's never been talked about before. It's really exciting when you find these little nuggets, you know.
Doing the police's work for them.
Brian Boyce, who Hugh Bonneville plays in the show.
Yeah.
So Brian was kind of integral to the Gold because I tracked him down, which wasn't particularly easy. He was very cautious about meeting me.
Really?
And yeah, I remember the first time I went to his house, he I won't say where he lives, but he lives in a little village, and I went in and he said, oh, he took me to a little kind of ante room. And he said, oh, you can leave your stuff here. And I said, no, I'm fine. And he said, no, leave your stuff here. And I had to sort of empty my pockets. And it was like being checked into a police station. I think it sort of had no recording devices or anything. And then over time, you start, you know, trusting me more and understanding the kind of story I wanted to tell. And I would go down probably a dozen times to his house, and we'd sit around his kitchen table for a few hours talking about it, then have lunch in his garden. And then ultimately he came to London and we had a nice long lunch, me, him and Hugh Bonneville. And he really, I mean, you know, he's in his late 80s, Brian. He's fit as a fiddle, really dynamic, fascinating guy. You know, he was involved with the arrest of the Craze when he was younger and ended up running the Brinksmack Task Force. He did lots of other stuff with the security services, which he couldn't really talk about. And, you know, so when you meet someone like him, it kind of gives you such insight to it. But I just remember the point of my story. My point was that after all the research, I would sometimes tell Brian something that he didn't know about the Brinksmack case. And that was a real thrill. You know, he'd say, I didn't know that. Oh, that's really interesting. And he'd say, yeah, that could be true. That could have happened, you know. So it's, that's the guy
that.
Who's in charge of it. So that's the level of research we go into.
How many of the other real characters did you actually meet?
A lot of people, some of which didn't want to talk to me, some of them I didn't feel would be appropriate to approach, some of whom were happy for me to say that I talked to, some of whom weren't. So it was lots of conversations, some of them very easy, some of them quite clandestine, all interesting. I mean, one of the most fascinating conversations I had, which is in the book, is I spoke to Mickey McAvoy, who was the leader of the Brinksmack robbery, and that's the only interview he's ever given. Sadly, he's not around anymore. He died shortly after, and he... That was a very strange conversation, because what I found was, because he'd been sentenced to 25 years and done a fair whack of that 25 years, and he was a man who I think was maybe in the later stages of his life, he sort of felt like he had nothing to lose. And weirdly, I felt it was one of the interviews I had did where there was almost no agenda, where he was just telling it as it was, very open about the fact he did the robbery, wanted to correct some of the common misconceptions about the robbery, you know. And I remember speaking to Brian Boyce after and saying, I spoke to Mickey McAvoy, and that was my perception of the conversation. He went, oh, yeah, he said, you know, some of these old crooks, they've got nothing left to lose at this stage. They've done their time.
Yeah.
So they talk about it. So that was really interesting. But there was lots of conversations. I mean, I went around Europe to speak to some people, and it was a constant source of wonder, really, as a story.
The music in it is amazing. Like, done such a great job with the score, but also, excuse me, those needle drops. You know, there's diegetic stuff that you hear that's within the scene, sort of thing that's of the time. And then just this brilliant use of needle drops, of like whether it's over the end credits, like it's a great Stone Roses moment after one of the episodes, season two. And it's almost like an extension of the episode in a way, almost like the swagger of that song kind of adds to the kind of like the feeling of that episode, or like where we are with a character in that episode. It's so good. It's a brilliant thing that music does, where it kind of makes you feel. Do you know what I mean? How do you work with music in terms of when you're writing? Do you write it in a script? Are you really involved in that side of it?
I kind of torture myself and probably torture everyone else with deliberating over music choices and just trying to get it spot on. You know, Guilt was probably the first show where I really invested heavily in the music, along with the directors and everyone else, of course, producers and script editor, everyone who kind of has been across it for so many years and has kind of views and the mood and the tone. But I think Guilt was very instructive to me in just how music can enhance a show, not just kind of partner a show, but really enhance it. And like you say, Edith, in terms of that, the tone of it and the energy of it, and it can give you something just extra. And it's a chance for you to tell the audience the show you're making, I think, your choice of commercial music. And it's too easy to say you're making a period show, shoving period music. It's not about that. It's about tone for me. And if the tone can also be in the period, that's great. I mean, with Guilt, just to divert briefly, it's like we use music from over about 40 years span, you know, which I love.
But like the character Jake had a record shop. You almost felt like a lot of the time that those choices were in his head almost, in a way, or him flicking through some of those records in his shop.
The record shops are eclectic places, you know. For me, you know, when I was growing up in Dundee, Groucho's record store, I'm sure you remember that, Edith. And then,
I think I bought my Soul to Soul hoodie from that very place. Spent my hard-earned, saved pocket money British Racing green with gold kind of lettering on it, soul to soul sweat hoodie. It was not cheap. My mum was like, "How much?"
No, Grouchers was a great. That was like a little portal to another world because they did the concert tickets and everything. You know, the buses, the tea in the park, and so on. But I think so. Record shops. You know, I lived in Leith for many years, and I used to go. There's a couple of great record shops in Leith Walk back then, and they are eclectic. You never know what's going to play when you go in, but it always sort of feels right, you know. And they've got this great span. So I think Jake's Record Shop gave us weirdly that sort of liberty to go across the decades and just get the right mood. And then with the gold, we were probably a bit more, we tried to be a bit stricter on period, but, you know, often there's a great song and, you know, Ed Bailey is a brilliant music supervisor. People will quite rightly say, just to let you know, this is, you know, 2 years out, 3 years out, and I really don't mind. I always say, the characters managed to get hold of a bootleg from the recording sessions just to kind of get us round it logically. And what's really exciting, I think, about the second series of The Gold is really getting into sort of my era now in terms of this was stuff that I was listening to when it came out, whereas the first series was a bit more before my time. Music that I know and love, but, you know, the second series, it's like, you know, when you drop Primal Scream and things like that, it's like, well, I bought that when it was released. To be able to put that into a show is really exciting. Series, which is just nuts for me, you know, as a huge fan. It's exciting when you get into the period where you were growing up, I suppose.
You got tickets?
Let's chat when we're offline, Edith. You're my last bet.
I've not asked yet. I'm terrified to even ask. I've got
It's funny, I was on the set of I'm making a show just now, and I was on the set the other day talking to Johnny Harris and Tom Burke, two of the actors. Sorry, Johnny Harris and Tom Hughes. Johnny Harris and Tom Hughes, and we were comparing what possible routes we had to tickets, and all trying to convince ourselves we had the most likely route, but they all sounded a bit shaky to be honest. But let's see.
Liam was renting a house not far from us in Selsley in Gloucestershire, and so he was walking his dog loads on Selsley Common, so I might have a couple of days deliberately taking my dog for a walk there in the hope that I bumped into him. Didn't work.
I think you're going to say, so you're going to buy a dog and you're going to start...
One step too far, come on.
Yeah.
Just go back to Guilt quickly as well, because I really loved Arthur Sharp's score on that, you know, and work on that. And he's a really, really talented composer, I think, as well. And I love the work, actually, that he did with Will on, my God, I forgot the name of the film there, but that brilliant film they worked on together, you know, the brothers. But yeah, talk to me about that side of it, and because that's really interesting. And I guess that directors who come and work on the show, and they have to kind of have their input into their vision for the show, both musically and emotionally and stuff, but working with those composers and the score alongside those really big sounding commercial pieces of music as well.
Score's interesting because you just have to take a slight leap of faith. You know, you look at someone's work and it's always brilliant, and you have interviews and interviews always go very well, but you just have to feel you've got that connection, and it's a group decision, and the producers involved and directors. I'm guilty of Robbie McKillop and Patrick Harkins, and then you've got Neil Webster and Nerys and Kirsty, the producers, and you have the meetings and get a feel of it, and then you do make that leap of faith. And when you get that first cutting of score, it's always a bit nerve-wracking, you know, and it was really exciting. Arthur did a fantastic job, and then you tweak it and give notes and try and fit it to scenes. And with The Gold, we had Simon Gough, who's incredible. He's really come on to that. He's released his own album. But I think the thing with the score for me is getting it right, for the scenes, but also I think there's, my big fear always is overscoring a show. I think that's very common. It's much easier to cut, obviously. So I think what we usually do is slightly overscore a show and then work out. And then my big thing when I'm really watching it, when we're kind of really getting to the nitty gritty of it, is do we need score in this scene? It's always the question to ask. And I think some shows, they just think it, oh, that'll add 10%, that'll add 10%. But suddenly you've got almost every scene with score. And I just think it snaps you out of the action a little bit. You lose a bit of the reality. So I always think sometimes less is more with it, you know, which still means there can be a fair whack. You know, if, I think that's a question that you should really be asking yourself when you watch those final mixes is, you know, is this additive? Are you ending up accidentally having three scenes in a row with score in it? And it makes it less powerful when you do bring it in, you know? So overscoring something, and I think composers would agree with that as well, you know, that they'd rather make the mark in smart ways than feel they're just kind of soaking it with it.
Let's talk about Simon. Why was he right for the job, and what was it about his work that really stood out for you?
And Neil Correa was the lead director in the first series, and then Lawrence Goff did the block two, and then Patrick Harkins did the second series. But I think it was probably around with us and Neil Correa looking at options. I can't remember if Neil knew Simon or knew of his work, but he certainly was part of a conversation quite early on. One of the things with Simon, and I always like with composers when they're musicians, and they're all musicians to some degree, but he's a kind of very much a musician. He does gigs and he plays all sorts of instruments. And I just thought he offered us something in early conversations that thought it'd be kind of dynamic, very, very cinematic, and kind of quite deep and cool as well. Like we talked about sort of the industrial influence and things like this. And he just, but you know, you just look a lot of their work and have a good chat. And sometimes off that first conversation, they'll send some specific other examples that you think might fit in because of what you said. Sometimes they'll run off and make something for you. And he just felt great from the start. He lives in Berlin, and you know, so we didn't actually, I don't think we met until we locked the whole thing and he came over for a screening. But he, so it's just lots of Zoom calls and conversations, and it's the score, it's just, it's fantastic. You know, it's really good. I mean, he released an album of the score for the both the first and second series, and you know, you can listen to that music.
Absolutely. And that thing as well that he's done so brilliantly is because, like we were talking earlier, there are so many characters, and it would be so easy to have, you know, like individual themes for every character and every kind of storyline. And it's kind of like the way that it's that's been kind of streamlined, so to speak, really makes it more impactful in terms of what he has created.
I think there's often a temptation, oh, let's give everyone a new world and stuff, and it just starts to sound mad. You know, it's kind of schizophrenic. There needs to be a sort of tonal unity to the whole thing. And also I like recurring score over the show. I like if we hit upon some lovely bit of score, you know, use it again. It becomes a little signature thing, you know, so which they always like to hear because it means they don't have to do it anymore. What? He was brilliant, Simon. He's done the second series as well.
Are there any specific scores or films for you where, you know, kind of as a fan, both in TV and film, really, that where the music kind of, you really kind of realised how important the music was to the storytelling?
Two of my favourite shows, in fact, if not my two favourite shows, I mean, I thought Sopranos just used music so brilliantly. And as you talked about earlier, Edith, that thing over the end titles where a lot of people don't think that's significant, you know, and I suppose sadly now people will see, you know, a lot of people don't watch the titles. But I mean, I think that outro music as a little sign off to the episode that you've just watched, with that music, you're almost confirming to the viewer that they've watched the episode in the right way, because you're saying, yes, this is the mood that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
This is the mood that we're in, having made it. And, you know, the music kind of recognises that. You know, so that's something I always remembered watching The Sopranos, of almost leaving you kind of giddy at the end because of their choice of music over the end titles, which could be anything, you know, famously John Cooper Clarke.
The bloody cops are bloody keen, bloody keep it bloody clean. Bloody chiefs are bloody swine, bloody draws the bloody line. The bloody fun and bloody games, the bloody kids in bloody blames. Nowhere to be bloody found, anywhere in Chicken Town. The bloody scene is bloody sad, the bloody news is bloody bad. The bloody weed is bloody turf, the bloody speed is bloody surf. Bloody folks are bloody daft, don't make me bloody laugh. Bloody hurts to look around, everywhere in Chicken Town. Bloody train is bloody late, your bloody way, bloody lost and bloody found. Stuck in fucking Chicken Town.
And then score-wise, Chernobyl, which I think is the kind of...
Oh, held up.
That, for me, is the sort of... I think that's the one sort of true television masterpiece of the last 10 years, where Chernobyl. I just think it's incredible. And I've spoken to Craig Mazin about it, because we were bizarrely nominated on the same nomination list for something a few years ago. I just thought it was incredible. And the score of that was, you know, talk about immersing yourself in a world. It's fantastic.
I was lucky enough to chat to Hilda about that, actually. Like how she physically went to places to kind of capture kind of sounds to kind of influence and inspire kind of what she, even what instruments she used or how she used the instruments and stuff to create that score. It's brilliant. She's amazing. Nice, so actually, connection with Simon, actually, because he worked on Joker, didn't he? He did some work on Joker Folie à Deux. So there
yeah,
we go.
There's right.
A nice wee thread through there.
Yeah, nice. Very nice.
What about film?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the only film I can think of is the last one I watched all the time. And the last one I watched was the Bob Dylan film. And now that was a bit of a cheat because they had the music. But I think... you know, that was just an incredible watch. But I think for me, it's like when you get an area of television or film right, it should become invisible and then weirdly memorable.
Yeah.
So, you know, the score and the direction and the writing, it should just all fit, you know, so you're watching something as a whole. And I often think where you get unstuck, it's where one of those people involved are sort of promoting themselves in a way that they're trying to draw attention to their own craft and it's not part of the whole. So, yeah. You know, and that writing, I can absolutely be with the writing, and I'm sure I've done that in the past where I'm a bit verbose or flourishing and it jumps out in the scene because you're just creeping away from how that character would naturally talk. Same with direction, it gets too gimmicky and it feels like the director's sort of waving to the viewer, and the same with score. It can just be a bit over the top, and again, they're throwing everything at it in a way that's not quite connected to the material. So the stuff I love would be when I actually just think about shows and television and films that I love. And if I went back and watched that, I'd say, God, look at that score. It's incredible. And what a great choice of track. But you shouldn't be noticing these things.
Absolutely.
It should be just completely unified and as such, almost invisible.
Well, that's kind of almost what I try. I don't get the luxury of doing that in kind of preparation for this, where more film than TV, where I get the chance to go and enjoy the film and just sit and watch it and then have a second viewing where I can kind of like make a point of kind of looking out for things, I think, because it's a shame sometimes where, you know, you've only got one chance to see the film before you do an interview and you're kind of almost like being distracted from the enjoyment of just being in it to kind of going, wait a minute, I need to write that down kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? So that's the dream for me as well.
I got sent these things the other day for the goal too, where they're doing signing off all the kind of marketing publicity things, but they do these little snippets online of bits and bobs from the show. Anyway, they sent it through and I said, look, I think you've dropped the score off. And they said, no, we can't use score because it's licensing or whatever, which is, I hadn't realized, I understand. But those little snippets without the score looked mad to my eye. To my eye, as I'm not a social media expert, but I thought, this is mad. Like, there was a running scene. Without the score, it looked like bloody Benny Hill or something, you know. Whereas in reality, I think it's a really dramatic sequence. So it kind of shows you how important it is as well.
Yeah. Do you write to music? Do you have music on when you're writing?
Not the time. And I kind of put a playlist together slowly as I'm writing a project of tracks that feel of an era or of a mood, probably more. But I can play music not when I'm outlining. If I'm outlining, I'm just on my whiteboards and getting increasingly fraught, trying to kind of work it all out structurally. When I'm writing, once I have the bones of a script and I just want to really enjoy the dialogue and stuff, I'll often play music then, definitely.
Yeah. This is a random question, but I always get like, I don't know, it's like you always get a slight, a little flutter when you hear your name on screen sort of thing. Is Harry Bowman a real character?
I'm afraid it's not inspired by yourself, Edith.
I wasn't expecting it to, but it's just like, oh, it might be related.
It's a great question because he's inspired by Dave Psycho Bowman, Dundee United.
The United player who I'm related to.
Dave Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
Edith, I know Dave Bowman.
His dad's my dad's cousin or something.
I know Bo. Every time I go to Tannadice, I seek him out. And, you know, he's still on the staff there. And I went up to the United, very kindly invited to the United training ground a few months ago, maybe last time I was in Scotland, went along with my boy and Bo came over and had a good chat and showed us around and everything. And so anyway, that's funny. Yeah. And did you meet him when you were younger? Was he not quite a scary relative?
No, not at all. It's that kind of sense of pride. His auntie Jenny actually is still in Pitt and Weem. And weirdly, when was I back? Easter. Bumped into her in little coffee shop in Pitt and Weem. So, yeah.
He famously...
I mean, he was a brutal player. Yeah,
his nickname was Psycho. When he went to Forfar, he famously got... I think he managed to get four red cards in one game, the last of which was dismantling the referee's dressing room door. Anyway, there you go. David Bowman's the inspiration for Harry Bowman. Yeah, there's lots of kind of surnames like that. A lot of it's because it's compositing characters.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of compositing of characters because there's so many real-life people involved. So you do have to rename them.
It's just that thing on screen where obviously people refer to him as Bowman. And so I get that. So you're just like, what?
That's funny. So well, there you go.
Shouted out on screen.
Yeah, it's your uncle once removed Dave.
That there we go. Psycho Bowman. What is next? What are you working on next?
I'm working on a show called Legends for Netflix, which
Coogan and
Steve Coogan, Tom Burke, Johnny Harris, Hayley Squires, and Ellen Neen. It's a brilliant story. It's another show inspired by real events. It's about customs investigators in the 1990s who went undercover into the international drugs world. So it's an incredible story.
Wow.
True story. I've been, again, doing lots of interviews and research with the people involved. We're on week 11 of 17. So, hence
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you for like kind of, you know, like dropping yourself into this then in the middle of it. Crikey.
I'm about to, as soon as we finish, Edith, I'm about to drive to, I'm not quite sure, some distant part of North London to work until midnight tonight. So it's,
Oh, Neil.
Anyway, can't complain. It's great. It's really, it's a really exciting show. And yeah, I think that, I mean, we're working on it and then it'll be edited and out at some point next year. But I'm excited about the goal coming out. I think because I've been so busy, I sort of forgot, you kind of forget that you've got, you know, TX coming up, and it's quite good in a way because I get a wee bit nervous before something comes out, but I've kind of not really thought about it yet.
Oh, well, it's fantastic. You know, having watched 4 episodes of it, it's fantastic. It really, really is. It's really transportative as well, you know, in terms of those locations and things that you're at, and kind of, and it just gives you kind of like, my God, this is literally kind of covering, you know, it's crazy.
Geographically, where it goes is amazing. And, you know, we shot, I mean, that was interesting because we shot, half the shoot was abroad. We did half of it here and then half of it in Tenerife. So Tenerife plays about 5 different countries and does it very well. I mean, it's really interesting, Tenerife. And I don't know if you've been to Tenerife.
Never much. Been to Tenerife, no.
So the south of it is very touristy and very arid, sort of as you'd expect. And then, but the north is, we stayed in the north in the capital, Santa Cruz, which is lovely. It's like Seville or something. It's all like cobbled streets and really pretty. But then it's just these bizarre little ecosystems within the island. So there's one valley that is just very tropical and lots of palm trees. So that was Burma for us, you know. And then there's one beach, because it's volcanic sand, it's the dark sand. There's one beach that's got golden sand. And we kind of shot the shit out of that from different angles with various options. And then, you know, you just got, and then it played, so it played the Caribbean for us, played real life Tenerife through the Palmer story. I think it played mainland Spain, Burma, somewhere else as well. I can't remember, but it was great fun, really, really good fun. I think that excitement for me of foreign film, you know, it reminds me when first television I ever made was Bob Seren, and that feeling I had of staying at my mum and dad's in Broughty Ferry and getting up and walking to Bob's house, you know, past the paper shop where I did my paper round, you know, and going for a pint in Broughty Ferry after filming, or going for a Chinese with Brian or whatever, you know, and that raw excitement of, I cannot believe that I'm doing this.
Yeah.
That comes back to me now, foreign filming, you know, when I'm driving through the sun thinking, I can't believe that I thought of this thing back at home and we're off to make it now in a foreign country. So it's... yeah, very exciting. I think it's a great story. It's been a brilliant show to make the gold. And I'm really excited we got to do the second series because it really is the second half of the story. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is the sort of almost like the bit that people didn't really know about or don't really know about. That's what's so exciting about it. I just wanted to say as well, just quickly on The Guilt before I let you drive off to North London, is it was such a great show and I just adored it so much, everything about it. And I feel like you did such a great service to Scotland as well and the creatives in Scotland in terms of what that show did. It really raised the bar in terms of what can be made in Scotland, how Scottish stories can be told, both kind of aesthetically, but just kind of the energy of the show and the confidence in it as well. And I just think that you just did so much service to Scotland and Scotland creatives in terms of going, come on, guys, this is kind of... you know, this is what we can do.
I appreciate that, Edith. And I know you've said similar before. I always appreciate you, the support you gave it. And I think that a lot of people did. They got on board early. It was just an amazing thing to watch it come together. And, you know, all you can hope as a writer is that people come on board and enhance your work, you know. And that happened with Guilt in terms of everyone that works on the show and the producers and the directors and then the performances are just incredible. I felt very liberated with Guilt. I mean, it's a very strange thing. And this is why I think it had its own idiosyncratic voice, a very unique voice, I think, I'd hope. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it's definitely unique. And it's because it was a weird commissioning process that it went through the head of BBC Scotland at the time, Ewan Angus, who'd backed me with Bob Servant back in the day. I met up with him and he said, I've got this new channel and we're looking for a drama. And I said, well, I've written a pilot of this show called Guilt, set in Edinburgh, these two brothers. And he said, oh, send it to me. And I sent it to him on the Friday and he texted me over the weekend and said, we should try and make this. And he made it. And it went kind of through him. And then weirdly, I think because my background, it sort of got some money from comedy, but it was never a genre show within the BBC. So it never went through a traditional editorial process.
Yeah.
And I think that's why all the rough edges never got knocked off, you know, and that's why it had a lot of humor. It had, you know, a lot of music, and it had much more humor than anything that I think you'd have seen on BBC drama at the time.
Mm.
And so it was this strange little thing of just getting a thing to screen without it going through a lot of those more regimented, I think, editorial. Yeah, exactly. And people thinking, look, it's, you know, maybe knock some of the humor out so it feels a bit more within our broader drama remit and all that stuff. Casting wise, we were just allowed to cast the actors really that we wanted to cast. We didn't have to get who were seen as like names that would mean something down south, a lot of the kids.
Yeah.
And it was because it was launching that channel as well, Edith. It was like, this is about showing Scotland and being very Scottish while being hopefully universal in terms of storytelling. So proud to go. I mean, it's my most personal show without any shadow of a doubt. There's all sorts of things and aspects of my life in there. And obviously, I lived in Leith for a long time, being a Dundorian, but then probably lived in Leith for about 10 years on and off. And it just feels very personal, the humour and the voice of it. And I think what's great for me is it did so well, and it was so exciting to see it do well and kind of get critically response and everything. But then internationally, it's nuts, you know, this and I do feel huge pride to that. You know, it got remade in India, and these two brothers. Yeah, it got remade in India. I'll send you the trailer. It's hilarious. It was called Bloody Brothers, and it was these two Indians, and they were at a wedding in the Himalayas, and they knocked someone over. And yeah, it's a proper Indian series. Which is just extraordinary, you know. And then it's gone out, you know, all around the world. I had lovely reviews in the New York Times and things. And it's just, I'm genuinely not being entirely sort of selfish about my reaction to that. I do feel this great pride in it.
Good.
And it's really exciting. And you read these, I love reading reviews in foreign newspapers where they talk about Kenny Burns and they talk about Leith Legals, you know. That's Leith Legals. Advert there, 99.99 wills. Make sure your loved ones are taken. So, you know, hearing people talk seriously about these goings on in Leith in these foreign newspapers and, you know, podcasts or whatever, I just think it's nuts. And I think it's distinctive show and so many brilliant Scottish actors. And even the casting, you know, sorry, I know I'm banging on a bit, but even because I'm so sort of proud of it as a show, but the casting. And this is so specific, where I was like, I really want East Coast Scots. And, you know, the confusion that caused in some conversations in down south, because, you know, and I thought, no, it's very distinctive, the voice and the tone of it. And I think, I always think there's a slight, I know Brian talks about this a lot, the difference of the East Coast and the West Coast humour and thing. And I think it's true. I think the East Coast has a slight more absurdist touch, if you like. And the West Coast has got this real realism.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I always think, from Dundonian, being Dundonian, that my stuff arcs back to William McGonagall, basically. And it's kind of like Michael Mara, you know, that kind of brilliant storytelling, but always that little absurdist touch. And I think that East Coast performance, I think you get that. Like Eamon Elliott, and, you know, he just, everything he does is kind of makes me laugh. And the best hands actor in the business, I always think, is those fluttery hands. And all of them, you know, Mark, Jamie, and we just, Egg, and Stu Bowman, he's from Wormit. And wow. You know, we just kind of stuffed it full of East Coast actors, and it just came together. And thanks again for your support of it, Edith. Always remember. And thanks for, you know, not making a huge thing about me walking the wrong way off the stage at the Scottish BAFTAs as well.
It's a big moment. Do you know what I mean? It's fine. It's all right. It's good.
That walk I had to do back to this stage to then exit. It's probably the longest walk of my life.
It's the fact they make you do it as well. It's like, oh, come on. Oh, God. Well, listen, I'll no doubt see you on that stage again soon, hopefully. And thanks so much for your time today, especially considering you're right in the middle of such a big project as well. But thanks for sticking with the gold as well and giving us this second season, because it really is just such a treat. And it's lovely to chat to you. Thanks so much, Neil.
See you soon.
Bye. We'll be right back. From the Score to the Gold Season 2, that's An Informer in the Darkness by Simon Gough, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with writer of the show, Mr. Neil Forsyth. My huge thanks to Neil for taking the time to talk to us. It's a real treat to get to spend time picking his brain and talking about his wonderful, wonderful creative mind. Also, Sally, for setting up that interview. Really appreciate you taking the time to sort that out for us. You can see season one and two of The Gold on BBC iPlayer now. And by coincidence, star of The Gold, Mr. Jack Loudon, was also my guest on our previous episode, a Soundtrack and Everyman Film Club special with Jack and writer and director of Tornado, Mr. John McLean. You can find that at edithbowman.com. And a previous episode that I recorded with Jack, actually, along with every other episode of the podcast. It's Soundtrackin' UK for our socials, so that's at Soundtrackin' UK. And we'd be really grateful if you could subscribe to our YouTube channel as well, Soundtrackin' Extra. We've got so much stuff going up there every week, so please do go and check that out. Next up, we're on a musical Mission Impossible tour as music overseer and composers. So we've got Cecile Tournesac and then composers Max Arouge and Alfie Godfrey, who join me to discuss their incredible work on Final Reckoning. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Winter is here, and if your furnace isn't keeping up, don't worry. Care Heating and Cooling has you covered. Our expert technicians are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. That means when Care shows up, we're there to solve the problem, not to push a sale. With 30 years of award-winning, trusted service, you can count on Care to keep your home warm and comfortable. Call Care Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or schedule an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.